Just got my Stacey fucking D t-shirt in the mail. Thrown down to the bottom of my stairs. Fucking beautiful. Get well, my friend. Get well.
You've got a real attitude problem, McFly. You're a slacker.
What the fuck is going on? My name is Mike. This is Ego and Vice. This is episode 17, I think. Wow, 17 episodes. Here we are. I always rave on that. Hey, wow, 16, 17. But hey, man. Who knew? Who knew we'd get this far? And who knew that I'd still be interested in it? Or the people that listen and give their time would still be interested in coming out and sitting here with a fucking bum like me. But hey, what are you going to do? Yeah, so I'm happy to be back, man. What's been going on? Shit, we just played a gig. Goat just played a gig at House of Targ on last Saturday. We played with Gutter Demons. We played with the Dreaded Rebels. And we played with a band called Wirecuffs, which is a friend of mine named Brendan. He also plays in a band, which I've played on this podcast before, called Slim and Popular. He has a second band on the go. He's a busy dude. And in Slim and Popular, I know he plays guitar and sings, and in this one, he's just a vocalist, and they put on a fucking rad show. The whole night was a lot of fun. It was a Chord Productions event. And as always, the House of Targ, was a hospitable host. Always treat you good there. And we had a fucking really great time. Gutter Demons were really fun. Big stand-up bass. And I realize more and more that the later we play in the night, I'm used to opening shows. We played right before the Gutter Demons, so I think we were like third on a four-night bill. And I've learned that the longer I sit in a bar waiting to play and watching bands, the more I tend to drink. And the more I tend to drink, the faster I forget how to play my guitar. Not that it really matters, because Goat's kind of the sloppiest band in the universe anyway, but you know what I mean? You still don't want to fucking offend anybody with your hideous, you know. Anyway, but it was good. You know, all in all, it worked out really well. And fuck, what are you going to do? That's life. If I was in this to play well and to, you know, shine on my instrument, I probably would have quit a long time ago. I do what I can. Yeah, so after that night, leading up to playing, like I said, I was having a few drinks, and after the show, I had more drinks, and Sunday morning rolled along, and fuck, I felt like absolute garbage. I felt like a fucking absolute garbage person. I rolled over in bed. I stared at the ceiling, and I was supposed to work that day. I called in sick, and because believe it or not, this is not my job. I actually have things that I have to go to make money to sustain the things like this that I do. I called in sick, and I spent the day basically writhing in my own filth and wishing for death. And unfortunately, or fortunately, it didn't take me that day. I bounced back. And I'm doing well, I guess. I called in sick yesterday, too. Took a couple days off. You know, you just need some time off from what you do. Starving artist, what are you gonna do? You know, you play in bands. You still need a day job. You still need to do your thing. But after a show, and you kind of let loose, and sometimes if you let loose a little too much, well, you pay the price for doing that. And I paid the price. So I took a couple days off just to find my brain because I apparently left it at Targ. But anyway, it doesn't matter. Rolled over on Monday morning. Felt better than I did Sunday morning, but still felt tired. You know, it was like the two-day hangover thing. So what I did was I rolled over, got on my phone, which I normally do, and just paid some bills. I paid my phone bill, and I paid put some money on my credit cards, which is long overdue. And I paid some back taxes. Look at me. I'm a fucking responsible citizen. Well, if I was super responsible, I probably wouldn't owe back taxes, but hey, what are you going to do? Government got a hold of me about 6 months ago and said, you owe this much from this time. And I was I knew it was coming, you know, they'll find you. The government will find you. And I try to keep up, you know what I mean? I try and pay my taxes on a regular basis. I'm a subcontractor. That's what I do. Like when you go to your job at fucking, I don't know, the Home Depot and you get paid and you get your paycheck, it's basically you get what you see what you worked if you're hourly, right? And they take off for like CCP, like the pension and then the GST or the HST and all that stuff. So all your taxes are done. So what you're left with is what you have. Because I'm a subcontractor, I actually charge my contractor HST for my services. So I am responsible for getting all my finances in order, if you will. Because if I go out and I make X amount of dollars, when I get my paycheck, I basically, I take home what I make. And it's my responsibility to take a certain percentage of that and, you know, put it aside for the government and whatever. And I do that. I do it. But there was, you know, sometimes you get a little behind in things, but, you know, I'm trying to keep up on it. But life is a motherfucker. And bills, there's always fucking bills to pay. It's amazing how hard we work in our lives just to get by and own the shit we own. Just, you know, just honestly, just to get by. Like you work 5-6 days a week, just busting your ass for what? Just to live in like mediocre things, I guess. I don't know. I have a decent, like I'm a subcontractor. I'm like my own business. So I make a decent living, I suppose, but it's just like, I don't have anything really nice, you know? Everything I own is cat scratched and covered in cat fur, and, you know, I don't like super fancy new things. I like old things with charm and character, so that's what I have, and it's crazy. And with the government, though, not to go down this path, but don't fuck with the government, because they will fucking get you, man, and they don't give a shit. They will take you and they will put you in like a little box and they'll squeeze that box and then they'll like fuck that box, and that's you. So try and be on top of that, or at least call if you're having problems with that. At least call the government and talk to them. Don't hide from them, because they don't appreciate that. As long as you call them and discuss it with them and make some sort of effort to pay it, whatever you owe, then they seem to be okay with it. And I guess they're kind of reasonable when it comes to payment. As long as you're paying, they will kind of cut you a break. But if you don't pay and you run from them, they will put you in that fuck box, I told you. It's true. Trust me. Fucking sucks. Anyway, enough of that. Sorry, I'm just going off on my thing. So yeah, the show was good. Episode 17. I have a guest in the studio tonight. He's a friend of mine. His name's Ken Ketchum. He's from the bands that I know. He was from Four Stroke. He's also in the Limburg Babies, and I know he has a new project, and he's going to be here for a interview, and we're going to get that underway shortly. But I figure until he gets here, I'm going to play some tunes. I'm going to play a long overdue tune from a band that gave me permission to play their stuff probably a few months back, and I've just had guests on the podcast. And I've just kind of lost, you know, I've been kind of trying to focus on the people that are in the studio. So since I have a little bit of time, let's play some local music. So I'm going to play a track off a local band, and I apologize if I'm butchering the name or the pronunciation, but this is the way I hear it in my brain, a band called Balanana. Right. These guys, we were in contact a couple months ago, and I promised, they had just finished a record, and I promised to play some music on the podcast, but I got super preoccupied with everything else that was going on. But hey, guys, I apologize. Here you go. Try to honor that. They have a new record out. It's called Hello Hoopla, and you can find it at balanana.bandcamp.com. As soon as I'm done playing this track, Ken Ketchum from the Lindbergh Babies is going to be in Southwood Studio. We're going to talk about what's going on in his life and a little bit of history with him. But in the meantime, this is a song called Pointless off of the new Balanana record, Hello Hoopla. Check it out. So that was Balanana. And again, if I butcher the pronunciation of that name, I really do apologize. This is Ego and Vice. This is episode 17. Can't believe it's 17. I have a guest in the studio tonight. His name is Ken Ketchum from local band The Lindbergh Babies and several other acts, which we're going to cover tonight. But how's it going, Ken?
Not too bad. How are you doing?
I'm well. Thanks for coming out. I'm always appreciative to have my peers in the studio with me. I know we've known each other for a little while. I don't think we know each other too well. So, I don't know. What's going on?
What's going on? I don't know. I'm here. I guess probably the main things that I would think of maybe talking about would be a bit about Lindbergh Babies. I have a newish band, Cultural Treason, that is about to come roaring back out of a bit of a hibernation that we've been going through this winter, appropriately enough. And then also probably I think the other thing that I'd be interested in talking about in particular is I've got the newly announced punk rock cover night coming up on March 9th. I got a project on that, which is pretty interesting.
Cool. Is that with Scott Jeff at Targ?
Yeah.
Cool. All right. We're jumping ahead because I'm sure there's lots to cover before we get to all these important things. we were talking off air because this is a radio show. We were off air.
Yes.
You weren't born in Ottawa. You didn't grow up in Ottawa.
No, I grew up in Toronto, and then when I was 18, I was working as a bike courier in Toronto, and I got a little bored, so I moved to Vancouver, and I lived there for 8 years, and then by way of Kingston for grad school, not jail, I spent a year in Kingston, and then I've been in Ottawa since 99.
Cool, man. And as far as music goes, how far back does that go? Were you always just a bike courier, and you looked on the horizon and said, "I'm going to quit this bike courier business and become a band guy, a music guy"?
Well, I mean, as pitifully as being a bike courier paid me, it always paid far better than being a band.
Oh,
as,
of course,
as you know. But I think I had my. I started my first band when I was in high school at 14, mm-hmm. and then had that one band, and then I had a couple of bands in Vancouver. Although, like, probably I think the entire 8 years I lived in Vancouver, I played maybe 10 shows or something like that. I was always trying to form bands, and then, you know, things would always fall through, and then, like, you know, mm-hmm. the drummer would quit and move to Nelson or something like that. And so it was only pretty much the last year and a half I lived in Vancouver that like I got anything that gelled much, and so, like, most of my musical history has been pretty much since I've been living in Ottawa since 99.
Well, I remember you when I first knew about you. You were in the band Four Stroke. Yeah. That band when you were 14, just before we jump too far ahead, what was the band called? Do you remember?
It was called The Vagrants. We were probably about the 800th band in the world called The Vagrants.
That's pretty punk. It was punk rock?
Oh, yeah.
It sounds punk rock.
I mean, our very first song, we did, like, I think somewhere in my house I have, like, a cassette tape of us doing an 8 minute long version of Warhead by the UK Subs.
There it is. 8 minutes. Okay, that's
cool.
Yeah,
we just kept on not stopping.
I love hearing the history of, like, the first bands and stuff, like the names and how they went and stuff. Where did you play when you were 14? Did you, like, was it like high school talent shows? Did you rent out your own?
Yeah, that. No, we just played like a few shows at school, and that was it.
Yeah. Okay. So when you went to Toronto, to BC, Toronto, you said you were in a bunch of bands.
Toronto, like, so growing up in Toronto, like, The Vagrants was the only band.
I'm sorry. And then you went to BC.
I went to BC, okay. And then, probably like a year or so after I moved there, some friends and I, formed this band called Vicious Dick.
Nice.
We'd practice, and then, like I said, like, sort of someone would move away, and then, like, we'd go on hiatus for like a year or two, and then we'd kind of, like, get it together, and then sort of it was this band that from about, like, 1991 till 1996, like, sort of existed mainly in our minds.
That's a good chunk of time, though, to be in a band.
Yeah, to be in a band that never plays shows and, like, you know, practices almost never. But like, we played two shows in, I think, 95, and then that was it. But then like, sort of in 1996, I was living in this house that had a basement, a basement jam space, and we just kind of, like, we finally pulled it together and finally got, like, a decent lineup, and we played, like, probably about six shows, you know, sort of in around town in bars and stuff like that, and that mm-hmm. was going well. And then our drummer quit, and then we sort of built this other band out of it called Snatch Bandits that actually recorded in this. Yeah.
You went from Vicious Dick to Snatch Bandits?
I went from Vicious Dick to Snatch Bandits, and I then after leaving Vancouver, I made a resolution that I would never again be in a band whose name revolved around anyone's crotch.
Fair enough. However, you can always kind of, if we're going to jump ahead a little bit, when you got to Ottawa, you formed Four Stroke.
Moral Hazard, actually.
Moral Hazard. Oh, Jesus Christ. See, I'm just trying to piece together these pieces. I apologize. Moral Hazard, yes, that gets away from the Dicks and the Snatches. But the Four Stroke, anyway, okay. Moral Hazard. How'd that come about?
First of all,
why'd you move from BC to Ottawa, of all things?
So this is basically like... when I was living in Vancouver, after a while, I got sort of tired of riding my bike around and thought, you know, maybe I'll go back to school. And I went back to school and ended up like getting a bachelor's in economics. And then sort of at one point, a couple of my profs kind of like pulled me over and was like, you will go to grad school. And my next best option was basically continuing to drive a delivery van for this company that was like teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. So I'm like, I'll go to grad school. And I went to Queens and Kingston and got a master's. And then like, you know, the federal government basically offered me a job. And I was like, well, you know, I don't even have like the van delivery thing as a fallback anymore. So like, yeah, I'll move to Ottawa. as unattractive as that may sound. So.
Yeah, well, I guess if you're going to work for the government, Ottawa's a good place to be.
Yeah.
And so you've been working for the government since you've been in Ottawa?
Pretty much. I've been a Fed for like 18 years.
Wow. So. Crazy. The punk rock Fed. But I guess the job was there. The career was there. You went to school for it. You got what you wanted, but... I guess the bug of music was still inside you. So
I mean, honestly, for me, if anything, it's like it was almost kind of the other way around, is that like, you know what, this is a job that's going to kind of give me the stability and also the free time so that I can do the other shit that I want to do.
I can
do music.
That's pretty important, you know, and a lot of people out there, a lot of musicians try to survive, and I guess they do. I guess it's the starving artist idea of where you just like, I'm just going to play music for my whole life. But as long as I've ever played music, I've always had the job, and music has always been kind of reaching for the stars type of thing, until I got to a certain age where music became more of like, I just love to do it, so I'm going to keep doing it.
Yeah.
So I suppose it is kind of a hobby, but we're talking a little bit back further. So it was still kind of a, there was the possibility at one time to be like, yeah, okay, this might go somewhere. So.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I know for me, like, you know, because I always, you know, sort of when I was in high school and like, you know, when I was struggling in like, you know, low paying jobs and stuff like that. And, you know, when I was a student, like I was always like sort of putting time and effort into like, you know, playing music and like practicing and stuff like that. And even like, you know, I don't know how often goat practices anymore. Like, I mean, I remember like in Vicious Dick, like at one point we were practicing three times a week. I'm like, to me nowadays, like the notion of practicing three times a week is like, holy crap. Like where the hell did we find the time?
Yeah.
But I remember like, there was a coworker of mine in the warehouse and he would, and he was in a band that like, they weren't punk rock, but he was really like trying to make a career out of it. And I remember like one time having this conversation with him and he was like, you know what, if I'm going to give it another year and then if like music doesn't take off, like I'm just going to completely quit and I'm going to go to school and I'm going to like, you know, sort of get myself onto another track. And I remember thinking it's like I don't know how you could do that. Like I don't know how you could say like, you know, I'm going to quit. Like I as kind of at that point, you know, sort of like I was in these bands that would hardly get any shows and would like, you know, play to eight people or whatever. But it's like, you know, if I'm not doing this, then I'm not complete. And so sort of like the notion that someone would give it up on the basis of like, well, you know, I'm not getting paid, so I'm not going to do it anymore.
Well, then
to me is just that like it was just really a sad statement.
If you make that statement though, you probably could give it up easy because you're in it for the wrong reason. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, although I don't want to he'd made a lot of sacrifices and things like that. But it's, I've always had this sort of, I look at the musicians that whose music has made the most impact on me, and it's like it's people who have not made a lot of money out of their music, most of whom, like, you know what, if they've managed to break even on tour, that's been lucky. It's like, you know, they've always had to work to support work like sort of day jobs to support themselves and things like that, and you know, the music has been something they've done out of a need to do it, as opposed to because it was going to be something that was going to make money for them. And it's like, you know, I don't have any lack of respect for someone who makes money out of music, no. But if the money is the reason you're doing it, like I think you're doing it for the wrong reason. But you know,
No,
what my judgment is not important.
No, I understand that. I completely agree with what you're saying too, because I've always considered myself kind of like a lifer, where, like I said, I've always worked a day job, and I've always, but the reason I do that is so I can do things like when I go to the studio and record stuff, or when I buy merch, or when I just even pay to put gas in the tank to go to Montreal to play a show. That's all done from a day job. That's not done on like from my music career.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter though, because that's why I do work, so I can still do this. I think if I didn't do that, my life would just be like work. Like right now, work is just like, oh yeah, fucking work sucks, whatever. But I can still do this stuff. I got a show coming up. I got band practice tonight. I'm going to sit at home and write songs, and maybe we can record these things. If I didn't have that side of it, the work side of it, it would just be like super depressing. You know what I mean? Work is kind of like a motivating thing so I can do all this other stuff in my life.
Yeah.
You know, the stuff I care about, right?
Well, and if anything, it's sort of like, you know, it's sometimes, you know, the source of frustration, which can, like the grain of sand creates the pearl. It's like, you know, sometimes work and other frustrating aspects of your life can lead great creative results.
Right. As far back as when you were 14, what did you do in these bands?
So this is like until the Lindbergh Babies started, I used to have this little kind of joke that I tell people, which is that, you know what, there are no pictures or recordings of me playing bass. So I've got plausible deniability on that, but I've done everything else.
Right.
So like my high school punk band, first lineup, I was just hands-free singer. Second lineup, I was guitar vocals. Then in Vicious Dick, I was guitar vocals. There were two of us, and we'd trade off guitar vocals. We'd trade off like battling over whose song would get learned and practiced next. And we would just kind of battle about all kinds of other stuff as well. Then Snatch Bandits, actually, I traded off guitar and backing vocals versus drums. So like me and this other guy would trade off guitar and backing vocals and drums.
Like during a show, like during practice?
Yeah. So there were three songs that I drummed for, and then the rest he would drum for. Yep. And then after he quit, we got like a good drummer. So I just went straight to guitar. Then Moral Hazard, I was like guitar backing vocals. Four Stroke, I was like hands-free singing and, you know, just kind of like running around terrorizing people. Lindbergh Babies was when I came out of the closet as a bass player.
You're like, hear me roar, world.
Yeah. And then Cultural Treason, I picked up the guitar again, so I'm guitar and vocals in that.
Okay.
So I move around, but it's funny. I was when we were doing kind of the fun jams that led to Lindbergh Babies, at one point I was like, hey, you know, I used to play drums in a band. Like, I'll kind of sit behind the kit and see how I do. Mm-hmm. And fun fact, if you go for, let's say, 12 or 13 years without playing a drum kit, and then you sit down behind a drum kit again, it's not like riding a bike.
I was gonna ask.
It's you forget, like, everything you knew.
Oh, wow. So were you always, like, when you were a kid, did you, like, sing in the shower? Were you part of the, like, church choir or something? Like, it sounds like that has always been kind of your...
I was part of the church choir, but that's probably more because, like, I grew up in a sort of nice area of Toronto where like they actually paid kids to be in the church, in the choir. So like a buddy of mine, like sort of, you know, hey, you want to join the choir? Like I'll get a signing bonus for $50 to get you to join.
Hell so, yeah, I do.
So I was like, you know, I think we negotiated like, you know, a certain amount of kickback and then, you know, so I don't have a copy of this, but my parents do. I'm on vinyl. You know, one of the church.
My first record.
Yeah, one of the church ladies. Awesome. You know, took a recording of us on her ghetto blaster, and we've got that, and then we went on tour as well. But but you know, I've always like I don't remember ever not wanting to be in a band. Like even before I got into punk rock, like I would listen to music on the radio or whatever, and I was always imagining myself doing it, and then sort of. When I was 13, I started getting into punk rock, and then it was just like I knew that I was going to be doing this. And then by the time I was 14, I was in my first band. So
okay, do you remember the stuff you were listening to before 13?
Yeah, so it was actually
other
like,
than gospel, I suppose.
Yeah, there was not a lot of gospel there. I only listened to church music when I was being paid to. But
okay, right.
But actually, my inroads, actually the first band I ever saw live, Big Country in 1983, like you were hearing their stuff on the radio all the time. And I just like absolutely loved this band. And mm-hmm. so my sister got me tickets to their concert when they came and played Toronto. And I was like 11 or something like that. It just blew my friggin' mind.
Blew your mind.
And then after that, I got like hugely into the Police and became like an obsessive listener of the Police.
Still fucking amazing.
Yeah.
I love the Police.
And I've never stopped loving them. And then I became like a huge Rush fan.
Okay.
And then, actually, I think it was the other way around. I think I was a huge Rush fan, and then I was a huge Police fan, and then I started getting into punk rock. And then, you know, for a certain period of time, I then like, you know, sort of like poo-pooed everything I'd liked before because, you know, I was trying to prove some credibility or bullshit like that.
Fair enough. That's cool. And when did the guitar start?
Well, it was basically like in my first band, you know, we started off playing like, you know, UK subs covers and exploited covers and stuff like that. And then we started writing our own songs and I'd like show up to practice and I'd like, you know, hum shit at people. And then at one point I was like, you know, it'd probably be a lot more productive if I could figure out how to play this stuff. So I
three started, chords all downstroking. Pretty easy.
Pretty much.
Pretty
and
good
then,
starter.
And then, you know, the guitar player quit. And so by that time I was like, okay, well, you know, I'll move over. Like, me and the bass player moved over, so we were two guitars instead of one, and then we recruited this kid and told him he was going to play bass.
Okay. So we've covered a lot of where you've been, what you've been doing, your kind of upbringings in music, the church, the bike couriers, the delivery service. Let's talk about Ottawa and let's a little bit more detail on these bands, which is kind of like what's going on now, because we're all in Ottawa now, we're all in the Ottawa music scene. Moral Hazard, how did that start? Like, what was that all about? Where did you find your guys? Are you still friends with them?
So Moral Hazard, it basically sort of grew very organically. I got to Ottawa in like August of 99, and it had been a year since I'd last played live, and I wanted to get something together as soon as possible. So the first person I talked to was Karen, who was someone who I used to date, and also like she had played bass in the last two bands that I'd been in Vancouver, mm-hmm. and she was interested in jamming, and she said, okay, well, you know what, the person we need for drums is this guy Dave. He drums for Resin Scraper. Okay. And so I basically like accosted him outside a show at the downstairs club on Rito, and I was like, you're gonna play drums for my band? He's like, yes, I am. so the three of us started jamming, and then Karen ended up not really able to go on with it. And then at that point, like I'd rented this house in Chinatown In part because I wanted to have like a basement where I could have a jam space.
Sure,
I'd,
yeah.
I'd set up my drum kit there.
That's cool.
And I was looking for a roommate, and this woman, Sarah, basically like sort of contacted me like out of a classified ad I put in the Citizen for, you know, the millennials listening, you know, when you were looking for a roommate, you used to actually like purchase ad space in the newspaper. It's bizarre. I know. And so like, you know, she showed up and she looked at the place and, she was like looking at my records and looking at my drum kit set up downstairs and stuff like that. And she's like, you know, yeah, I think I want the room. And like, you know, do you have a band going or something? And I was like, well, yeah. And she's like, you know, do you need a bass player? And I was like, actually, yeah, my bass player just
holy
quit.
Fucking convenient, eh?
And so, so that was the very first show that Moral Hazard played. We played in December of 99. And that was a three-piece. Me, Dave Fott, and Sarah. I wanted actually another guitar vocalist because I am far from God's gift to guitar playing. I like to have
you're preaching to the choir, sir.
I like to have at least one other guitar player in any band that I'm in. We ended up talking to this guy Steve, who used to sing for a local band called Black Triangle, like a legendary hardcore band from the early 90s. And so he was like, well, you know, hey, I'll come in. And it's like, I'm thinking, well, you know what, maybe if I'm not doing the lead vocals, maybe I'll be able to, like, you know, carry enough of the guitar
sure.
on my own.
Yeah.
So he came in and we did one show as a four piece. And then, but I was still interested in having another guitar player. And he said, you know what, there's this guy, Chris, who he used to be in a band with my brother. So like maybe he'd be interested in coming in. So Chris came in, and then that was us as a five piece. And that was Moral Hazard. That was basically the lineup that we recorded our album with and played like for the first couple of years. And we played like Toronto, Montreal. We played Bumpers probably about 40 times for those that remember Bumpers. And if not, it's the Works across the road from Birdman Sound on Bank Street there. Mm-hmm. We went up and played the Canadian Forces Base in Petawawa a couple times. And it was this really great time just playing like sort of punk/hardcore. After a certain period of time, Sarah moved on, and so we got this other guy, Steve Rowe, came in on bass. But otherwise, like we had a very solid lineup for about close to 5 years. And
so you guys were kind of seasoned in Ottawa then.
Oh yeah, and I mean like so, we played lots of shows with, you know, sort of bands like the Riptides, the Creeps, Token. We'd play a lot with touring bands, so like Bunch of Fucking Goose would come through, we'd play with mm-hmm. them. Discords from Montreal, the Ripcords from Montreal, a little bit better known.
Paul Gott.
I say from Ottawa, from Montreal.
That's cool.
So I don't know. That was Moral Hazard.
Well, that sounds like a pretty established punk rock band in Ottawa with the amount of times you played for the amount of time you were together and for some of the crazy bands that you played with. Bunch of Fucking Goofs, that would have been fun.
Oh yeah, well I mean I grew up in Toronto, so like, you know, I would go and see those guys, and like, I mean, I remember sort of the days when Bunch of Fucking Goofs would be playing and you'd go and you'd like walk through the alleyways and you'd look for an old broken TV that someone had thrown out mm-hmm. because if you show up to the show with a TV, you don't have to pay cover. You bring in the TV and that's your cover because they had this ripping song called Pre-Programmed
okay.
that is all about television. And during
the
show, like the people
TV?
Are smashing yeah, the okay. TVs with baseball bats.
That's awesome.
So, you know, there's more than one show I got into for free on the strength of a TV.
The old Sony Trinitron
yep.
got you into the punk rock show. So after 5 years of having an established band like that, you said that you replaced the bass player. How did it all kind of...
So basically, so Steve Hopkins, our singer, he is still, like, we're still in touch. He's in the Army right now and was the whole time I knew him, based in Petawawa. And just at one point, it was getting kind of difficult for him to, like, you know, come down at that point.
Commute?
We were practicing twice a week, although he would come down for one practice a week, and then the other one, like, we just practice a four-piece. And then our drummer Dave, like the only drummer ever in that band, he was in a second band, and he was just having a hard time making all of his time commitments work. So at one point he said, you know what, I need to quit a band, and this is the one I'm going to quit. And then so Steve, the singer, said, well, you know what, if Dave's going, like, probably now is a good time for me to go as well. So,
yeah. So I'm just kind of, yeah.
Yeah. And so then at that point, Chris, the good guitar player, said, you know what, I think I'm probably out too as well. At that point, so I guess I've gotten ahead of myself. Probably about a year before Moral Hazard broke up, one time we got a show offer, and I was, like, answering the guy, and I said, like, look, you know, I think we can do it, but Steve, our singer, is going to be sent to Afghanistan, but I don't know when, because, like, you know, the military don't ask me permission on deployments. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say a conditional yes. And he's like, okay, yeah, fine. And then never heard from him again. And then one day, like, we go on Punk Ottawa, and it's like, oh, there's this show announced where, like, Moral Hazard is playing the show, but Steve's going to be in Afghanistan, so we can't do it.
Oh.
So I talked to the rest of the band, and they're like, well, we want to do it anyhow. And I was like, well, I'm not comfortable playing the show as Moral Hazard without Steve. Like, especially, you know, he's going to be off in Afghanistan. Like, I think that's kind of disrespectful. So we talked about it a bit, and it's like, well, why don't we do it under a different name? So we, like, kind of talked about it. It's like, okay, well, how about we'll call ourselves Four Stroke if we're doing shows.
This is like a complete bleed into.
Yeah. So if we're doing shows that Steve can't do, we'll call it Four Stroke. And so at first, like, Four Stroke was basically Moral Hazard minus Steve. And the thing is that because once a week we'd be practicing without him, like, you know, I had lots of practice, like, singing these songs. So that wasn't a problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
So for about a year, we were kind of going on two tracks, and we were starting to, like, write some Four Stroke only songs, and then we had some Moral Hazard songs. So it was basically like we had one and a half bands going on.
So Four Stroke is in its incubation time. Well, kind of together already. Before we get into too much more of that, can we listen to a Moral Hazard song? Can we play one?
Do it up.
What would you like to hear?
So I guess
as we look at the CD case,
what I would pick here would be Waste of My Life.
All right. This is Moral Hazard. This is Waste of My Life. So that was Moral Hazard. That was a song called Waste of My Life. which eventually started turning into four stroke.
Yeah, so essentially, I mean, like I said, we sort of originally four stroke was almost just basically a name to call ourselves when Steve was out of town, and then like sort of as time went on, we started writing some songs specifically for that band, and then Dave and Steve both decided to quit at the same time, and Steve Rowe, the bass player, and I decided we'd keep it on going, even though Chris decided that he was going to bow out as well. So we basically, a friend of our friend, this guy John Kiley, got recommended to us to come in on drums, and so we started jamming with him. And again, through Punk Ottawa, which was a fucking awesome community resource back in the sort of early 2000s.
Yeah, I think you can still get on that site, but is it still active?
I don't know. Like, I haven't gone on it for years. Like the more recent times I've gone on it, it's just like, I don't know if the bandwidth is really low or something like that, but it just seems to take forever to load. And I guess the message board started disintegrating into sort of a bunch of really unproductive discussions. And then I think, you know, sort of as like other types of social media and Facebook and Twitter took off, like, people stopped going on there. But I mean, at one point, I mean, like, people would be on there all the time, and you'd have this, like, you know, ongoing discussions of you know, all kinds of, like, you know, be it the music scene or, like, you know, politics. Like there was a lot of interesting discussions and conversations on there, and like, you know, sometimes you'd get to know people, or, like, you know, you'd be at a show and you'd be talking to somebody like, oh, like, you're so and so, like, oh, that's kind of interesting, although, you know, you said that one thing about Iraq that really pissed me off, but I mean, it was neat, it was interesting, and I think it really sort of aided the development of the community. Although I remember I got in this one debate with Scallon on it, where I was like, there is no such thing as the punk rock community. He disagreed with me. And in retrospect, I'm going to agree with
him. Well, I remember up until maybe even like a few years ago, I was trying to put Goat, like, because it says, if you want to list your band on Punk Rock Ottawa and stuff, just put it here. And I'd put it up there, and I put it up like three different times over the course of an X amount of months, and it just never went up. I'm like, is this site even fucking working anymore? So I don't know. I haven't been to that site in years.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, time was that it was, you know, you want to know if there's a show going on this weekend, like, you'd go on that. But, and, you know, sort of if you want to engage with people, or, you know, yeah, kill some time at work or whatever, like that was, sure, that was a thing to do. And, but like I said, I think, you know, it's been supplanted by, you know, Facebook and Twitter and whatever else.
Message boards were huge. I remember them. You could just go on
Tinder,
a message board,
like,
and,
like,
just,
you know, people used to be trying to date each other on Punk Ottawa.
Yeah, right.
Now there's Grindr. So
oh, right. Okay, you got Grindr. You got Tinder.
Exactly.
Punk Ottawa is a thing of the past, my friends. But it was cool. I remember message boards, and they were fun. You know, you would just get in there and you'd get in debates or just share information. Like you said, it was cool. Kind of a thing of the past, though, I guess.
Yeah.
Oh, so four stroke is moving along.
Yeah. So basically, we started jamming, and we had John Kiley, and then we got this guy Mike Jones who came in, because, like I said, I really don't like to be in a band where I'm the only guitar, because I'm not that great a guitar player. And so we started playing shows. We probably played for about a year or so as a four piece, and we did like sort of a bit of a demo CD, and, you know, got some good shows. We played with we went out and played Spider Fest, or I think it was called Punk Fest back then. We played with the Black Halos, with Zeke. Trying to think, you know, it's a while back, but we got a few good shows. And then, interestingly enough, so
was
Chris...
Zeke, I think Zeke was like Epitaph or Fat Records?
I don't know.
Okay.
But Chris, who'd been the lead guitar in Moral Hazard, he started saying, he's like, well, you know, hey, do you mind if I start coming out to the occasional practice? So he started coming to practices, and we'd do this thing where he'd play guitar for about half the practice, and then I'd just do, like, hands-free vocals. And then... for a few months, we started playing these shows where I'd probably play for the first half. I'd play guitar and sing for the first half of the set, and then the second half of the set, he'd take over, and I'd just, like, you know, run around hands-free and
Who was writing the songs?
So
have you always been a songwriter?
Or? I've always been a songwriter. So, I mean, like, Moral Hazard, I mean, there's writing and there's arranging, right? Because, like, you know, someone shows up to practice and they're like, you know, I've got, you know, here's two riffs. And, you know, even if someone shows up and they're like, you know, I've got these two riffs and then, like, you know, this song structure and whatever, you throw it to the band and it's like, you know, the band is doing the arranging. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that said, I did most of the writing in Moral Hazard and then sort of especially like the first Four Stroke album was mostly my writing. Although again, like, you know, sort of collaborative arrangements with everything and certainly like a lot of.
So the first Four Stroke incarnation must have been a lot of the writing from Moral Hazard then.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of things bled over.
So then
I am a shameless self-cannibal. It's like, you know, as far as I'm concerned, like, you know, any song that I write, or honestly, like any song that you write, if you're in a band with me, I can play forever and ever.
Like, just what do you mean? Just like you just like you're like a blues jam, and on a Sunday afternoon you just keep going and going, or you just
no. What I mean is elaborating on it, or like so. I mean the Moral Hazard CD. There's a bunch of songs on there from Vicious Dick, like two bands ago that okay. I'd been in Vancouver. Moral Hazard, the first Moral Hazard CD, the first Four Stroke CD, there's a bunch of songs there that were written for Moral Hazard, and didn't get recorded. Culture Treason, like we've just recorded a demo and you know, whether live or on that demo, there's some Four Stroke stuff. I mean, like, as far as I'm concerned, my entire back catalog is fair game.
Oh, tell us your process of writing a song. Like, if you were going to sit down with nothing, what would you do? Like, what do you have? You don't have a formula. You just.
I kind of wish that I was religious, because if I was religious, I'd say it's like, you know what? Basically, I get an email from God in my brain, and okay. It's just like, you know, here's the song. Like, there it is. Like it literally, I don't have a creative process. I don't do anything. It just, like, sort of, it occurs to me, it pops out fully formed, and it's like, you know, there's the song. I mean, that's. Not always, like sometimes I put more work into it, although honestly sometimes I feel like the songs I put the most work into are the shittiest ones, and the ones that just, like, you know,
you thought about it too much or something,
ones that spring fully formed into my brain without me having any, like, conscious creative effort at all are the best ones.
So okay, on that note though, it sounds like you have this endless flow of, like, creativity. Do you ever hit, like, a writer's block with that kind of mentality or that kind of formula?
Totally. I mean, there are some times when I'm coming up with, like, you know, a bunch of new songs all at once, and there are other times when just kind of nothing happens. And I mean, at this point, I've stopped sweating it. You know, sort of things will come when they come, and you know, I don't really kind of push on myself anymore. I mean, I think like the one thing is if I start feeling like I'm running a little dry, I'll just, you know, make more time to just kind of sit around with a guitar and screw around, and then eventually things will start coming out again. But again, like the ones I strain the hardest for are the ones that are probably worth the least.
Fair enough. I go through crazy, crazy long stages of like nothing. There's little moments, and I guess this is with anybody who writes music. I don't know shit, because when it comes to Goat or when it comes to my other projects, I'm the one who's kind of coming up with certain ideas for songs and stuff. And sometimes I'll like write one song and I'll go on this long kind of track of just like, I just wrote like three songs in like however amount of time, and they're songs that I will bring to the band and we'll put together. But there are times, and these are more than the creative parts, where I just go like months and months and months without writing anything, because I have nothing. I feel like I have nothing to say, nothing to write. Every guitar line I come up with is like, I've heard that 1,000 times. Nobody gives a shit. You know what I mean? So that's crazy to hear. Like, but I have a formula. I always try the same formula because I don't know how to write without that formula. But hearing you say, well, you just, I get a message from God and it comes out. I wish. So if God, hey, sir, you fuck, if you're listening, give me a fucking message.
But you see, the problem is that I don't believe in God. So it's like, so I don't know where it's coming from. It's just like, you know, magically appearing. But I mean, seriously, and it's even like literally this morning I woke up and I had like some music in my head. And it wasn't even like I wish I could say it's like, you know, oh, there was this really amazing song. I was like, you know what? That kind of sounds a little mediocre to me, but I was like, you know what? I'm gonna get out of bed. I'm just gonna like whip out the guitar and like, you know, record it on my phone so that, you know, I can think about it again when I'm not like super exhausted. But that's pretty much my thing. Is like, you know, and especially honestly, like most often when I'm going to bed or when I'm waking up, like suddenly I'll get like a snatch of music going through my head, and then it's just a case of like I need to find an instrument, you grab my phone, or if I don't have an instrument handy, just like, you know, hum it into the phone, and it's like, you know, I put it down there and it's like, you know what, I'll listen to it again when it's time, and maybe it's good. Most of the time it isn't, but you know, if you don't give each little piece a chance, then you'll miss the ones that are good.
The old smartphone voice recorder is a godsend. It's just absolutely, it's there for you. You do a little line, you do a little riff, you even say like a title of a song, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, okay, I might be able to do something with that.
The hilarious thing is that what I used to do, you know, back before I had a cell phone, is I would be out, or it's like, you know, I'd be at home and I'd call my answering machine at work, or I'd be at work and I'd call my answering machine at home, or I'd be out at a bar and I'd call my answering machine at home. And I remember like when I was married, like, you know, sometimes like on a Sunday morning, my wife would be telling me, it's like, you know, you left yourself a message last night and I listened to it. And it's like, hey, there's my next
song. That's a good song. Yeah. That's awesome. That's super cool. I've said this before, and I'm sure a lot of like songwriters or musicians can relate to it. I'm sure you can too. But if I could make like $1 million off half songs, I would have more than $1 million. I have more half songs in my life, or quarter songs, that started out really, really strong. Like, this is going to be good. Lose interest. This fucking sucks. And you never pick it up again. You know what I mean? To the songs that get finished. And I'll always go back through that whole voice recorder on the phone, and I'll be like, I don't even remember playing this. I really like this. You know, it's really funny.
And then sometimes you're sitting there and you're like, okay, this is a good riff, and this is a good riff, and can I put them together? And you start trying to like force these two things together, and it's just like, there are songs that I've done where I've actually succeeded in forcing those two riffs together, and it doesn't work. It's weird that sometimes, yeah.
Songwriting's tough. I'm self-taught guitar. I'm self-taught vocals, if you want to call what I do vocals. But it's funny. It's like you just start playing stuff. I don't know how to write a song. I just listen to music. I know what I think sounds good. I find something catchy, and it's just like, yes, this works. I bring it to the band. Sometimes I'll bring a song to the band that I think is an absolute piece of shit. But then you start playing with the band and you start working it out, and you're like, holy shit, this is actually not bad.
Yeah.
And it's trying to get out of the basement with the shitty song to bring to them. That's the difficult part for me. Once it gets to the band, sometimes you play it out and it's still a piece of shit. But sometimes it's great. It's just...
Well, and it's also, I mean, I think again, just with the whole talk about arrangement is that, you know, when you bring something to the rest of the band... In the military, they have this adage, which is like, no plan survives contact with the enemy. And it's like, you know what? No song survives contact with the band, because like it gets changed and it sort of like twists and turns in different ways. And sometimes if you have like, you know, a really strong vision of what it should be, you can try to like, you know, force it back to where it was. But I mean, often a lot of the time, you know, I really sort of sit there and I say, you know, I came here with this amount, but I wasn't really sure of it. And then you kind of like sit back and let other people like put their creativity into it. And I find that sort of a lot of the time it'll make it better. And even, you know, especially if there are elements that you're like, you know, I've come up with this, but I'm not totally sure. And then like other people start messing with it. And then without even necessarily knowing what the faults were that you found in it, they'll find ways of changing it.
That's fair. Let me ask you this question. I remember when I was like 22 years old and I'd sit down with a guitar and I'd play a song and I'd write some lyrics and I'd be like, that's the deepest shit I've ever, you know what I mean? It's like, everyone's going to love this stuff. Do you find, cause we're both north of 35. I'm going to leave it there. We're both north of 35. Do you find that writing lyrics at this stage in your life is more like that? Nobody cares. Nobody wants to hear this anymore. You know what I mean? Do you find it's like because I remember when I was a kid, I used to write that angsty kind of stuff or that kind of angry kind of stuff or, you know, stuff that made me feel like, yeah, people are going to want to hear this. I find that nowadays I write stuff and it's just like, this is so done. It's like, I'm a complete fraud writing these lyrics. I don't really feel them. They just kind of sound right because it's punk rock. Do you ever get that feeling?
Frankly, like in Moral Hazard, like I already chose the Moral Hazard song to do, but there's one in there called Nothing, which was literally about there. It's like, you know, I have nothing to say that hasn't been said before. Mm. And the thing is that, I mean, I've been listening to punk rock, not for my whole adult life, but for, you know, all but 13 years of my life. So, you know, while I love the genre and sort of revel in it, at the same time there's sort of, I think that I'm really alive to sort of all of the cliches in it. And so I intentionally, it's interesting, in Cultural Treason I'm doing a little bit more overtly political stuff for really the first time ever, just and I mean, it's not overt, but it's more overt than I've really ever gone before, just because like we're into a very, very like frighteningly unprecedented time, you know, politically with the stable genius to our south. But you know, sort of even when I'm doing that kind of overtly political, I'm trying to find ways of doing it in ways that aren't overdone. So it's like, you know, I have almost never written a song about a girl.
I don't know how to do that anyway, but
I have, like, you know, sort of, I steer clear of, you know, sort of most of the kind of, you know, obvious political tropes. You know, I think there are some songs lyrically that I'm more pleased with than less, but I mean, I am very kind of alive to that, you know, what the hell am I saying and what is the value of it and what does this add to anything? And I mean, I think sort of, I guess for myself and, you know, cards on the table, and this is prefacing something that'll probably come up later in this, but my all-time favorite band is now and has been since I was a late teenager, this Winnipeg band called Personality Crisis. And I think one of the things that I've loved about that band, while there are some bands that I've loved that are quite overtly political, their songs, like lyrically, are kind of, don't get into that and are just sort of like more about, I mean, personal reflection or whatever. And I think that sort of some of my better lyrics go that way, or, you know, are just lame ass attempts at being funny, which, you know, amuse me. And if other people don't like it, screw them.
Yeah, screw them. Okay, we're at an hour and 2 minutes here. This is definitely going to turn into a two-parter. Didn't expect it to, but it's going to, because, Ken, you're a super interesting guy and you have lots to say. So, before we end part one, can we play a four-stroke song?
Yeah, and seeing as we were talking about lame jokes and you know, I've written one song in my life that I think is kind of like a half-assed hit, so we might as well play I Want to Be a Suburban Jihadi.
I Want to Be a Suburban Jihadi. This is four-stroke, Ego and Vice.
'Cause I wanna back to mommy and daddy.
I wanna be a suburban jihadi.
Guide to me, that girl don't fuck with me.
I wanna.
Johnny Walker Lynn, the American Taliban. Charles Bishop, the 9/11 copycat killer. Dirty bomber Jose Padilla. Richard Reed with a bomb in his shoe. Spokesman Adam Perlman, how's being famous working out for you? I'll attend to that genocide, I'll drink it only hate. I'll swear at a fatwa against the United States, and I'll drive a car bomb into a crowd of kids. And I'll hack the heads off tied up hostages for a recruitment bid, because I want revenge upon me and daddy.
I want to be a suburban jihadi.
Yeah, to be a necro, don't touch me.
I want to be a suburban jihadi.
I'm 73 virgins if you count me.
I want to be a suburban jihadi.
And I really get back to mommy and daddy.
I want to be a suburban jihadi.
So that was the late, great Ottawa band Four Stroke. That was a song called I Want to Be a Suburban Jihadi. This is the end of part one of my interview with Mr. Ken Ketchum. Check out part two. Should be out in, early next week or end of this week. Either way. So if you want to get a hold of me, you can always contact me at egoandvice@gmail.com. You can check out the website at egoandvice.com. If you want to be on the show, if you want your band on the show, you want me to play some tunes, or you want to sit down and we can have a talk, be fun. Don't forget to check out this weekend, Saturday, at the House of Targ, the Remy, he'll be there too. The Lemmy, re-revisited, tribute. To the one and the only Mr. Lemmy from Motorhead and Hawkwind and everything else he was in. Goat's playing about three or four Motorhead covers, and it should be a good time. Lots of bands on the bill. And go to the House of Targ .com or their Facebook page and check out the band listings for that. The times, I don't know, I think it's like 8 o'clock, 19 plus. All your donations... Or what you pay at the... It's pay what you can, because all the donations go to a really great cause. Okay, so this has been Ego and Vice, episode 17, I believe. Crazy. Cool, man. Check out next week. We have part two with Mr. Ken Ketchum. See you later.
You've got a real attitude problem, McFly. You're a slacker.